Welcome to the Innovators and Investors Podcast. I'm Christian Marquez, founder and CEO of Finstrat Management. At Finstrat, we provide CFO-led accounting, finance, and reporting services to assist clients monetize their business. Stick around to the end of the podcast, and I'll share how you can be our next guest. Now, on to the show. Hello, and welcome to another episode of the Innovators and Investors Podcast. I'm your host, Christian Marquez, founder and CEO of Finstrat Management. Really excited because with us today, we have Edward Hyatt. Edward is the Chief Customer Officer and board member with Mechanical Orchard. Edward, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Pleased to be here.
So why don't we start with Mechanical Orchard? Would love to know what problems it's solving in the market.
Yeah. Well, I think it's a very interesting company, and I think it was founded just at the right time. It's about 2.5 years old now. So founded kind of at the tail end of the pandemic when who knows what was happening with startups and investment and so on. It came out of an idea that our founder, Rob Mee, our CEO, has been toying with for, frankly, decades, which is how to modernize or how to find a way out of the very, very oldest legacy software and systems that many large enterprises are faced with still maintaining today, right?
Okay.
Rob founded a company called Pivotal Labs back actually in the 80s, which grew into a software development consultancy and then built a cloud platform and had lots of success. So it was all about teaching enterprises how to build great software with modern methods, and that included cloud migrations. So we got into a lot of different activities in that area of cloud migration and so on. But this problem of the very oldest, you know, I'm talking about systems from the 60s, 70s. We never really cracked that at Pivotal. So he wanted to come back to that and revisit it and make a company just about that, dedicated to that problem of modernizing, let's call it mainframe and mainframe era systems.
Okay. And so, you know, for the benefits of our audience who aren't as familiar with these legacy systems, can you give us a characterization of what some of the technological challenges are in a migration?
Yes, absolutely. And probably it may be news to some people that mainframes are still out there, right? In fact, I think if you're around 20, 30 years, people would think that mainframes by now would be in museums at most and not actually part of our infrastructure in the enterprise. But it turns out that's not true at all. 70% of the Fortune 2000 run a mainframe for something core to their business. 91 of the top 100 banks in the world by size do as well for core banking, right? So these are entrenched systems that actually are still running, I would say, a lot of what we all experience as consumers and as business users of enterprise software, right? Behind your cool iPhone app for your bank almost certainly sits a mainframe, if you're at a large bank anyway, right? So to your question, why is that? Why has this sort of system persisted and is it still out there? Because we talk a lot in software about the cool new stuff, cloud and AI and all the rest of it. And here we are talking now about these very old systems, which are kind of from a different era, from a different ecosystem. They're not really part of the cloud dynamic. You can't really use the latest AI and open source and all the rest of it. We're talking about systems that are, let's focus on mainframe, written in languages such as COBOL or PL1, if you've heard of those languages, that truly are from the 60s, maybe even earlier, I'm not sure, but before my time. They can comprise tens of millions of lines of code, right? And that language it's not a dead language, but fewer and fewer people know it. But more importantly than knowing the language, those systems, if you can imagine, they're 50, 60 years old, have gone through many, many, many changes over the decades, right?
Sure.
So now they are complicated, patches upon patches, bug fix upon bug fix. Different generations of people and consultancies have gone in there and tried to improve them. They're running on hardware and software infrastructure that is sold to them, rented to them by a few players in the industry. So it's quite expensive and it's kind of a captive market. So it's possible to increase prices there almost at will, frankly. Those who knew the systems have retired long since, and there's often sort of one or two people left who kind of know how it works and kind of keep it running. But that's all a very scary proposition for the enterprise, right? Because If you're going to get an audit, you can't really say what really is the flow of data. If you're going to get asked to fix a bug, you're paying crazy amounts of money and it's very fragile. Now, at the same time, these systems are pretty stable, actually, right? They kind of work, right? And they're also very critical to the enterprise, right? You know, you're talking about hundreds of millions of dollars per week flowing through some of these systems, right? Like every wire transfer you do at your bank is going to go through a system like that, probably. So, you know, this is why they haven't been changed over the years. They're very fundamental. If they go down or if you break them, it's a big deal for the today business of the company you're in. And that's why they've kind of festered, you might say. And we're now in this situation where there's just huge pressure on making a change. But maybe to more fully answer your question, why hasn't that change happened? Well, it's because it's so risky, right? And as long every year that goes by, it gets more risky because who wants to be the CIO who says we're gonna go for it and we're gonna jailbreak this mainframe and get it onto the cloud? Well, if you fail, that's headlines, right? Most CIOs I talk to have actually gone through an effort like that over the past, you know, 3 decades. This is actually a 3-decade-old problem that many have tried to solve. But we think that even today, more than half the efforts ultimately fail, right? And so people are stuck in this difficult balance of, on the one hand, huge pressure to make a change because the talent's retired, the systems are creaking, it's expensive to maintain them. On the other hand, the risk, you know, can really balance that out because who wants to be the one who messes it up, right? You tend to get results of these projects that are more expensive than expected, take longer. You tend to get code in a modern language that's not really very readable. We can talk more about that. You end up with kind of your mess, but on the cloud, right? Oftentimes, if you are successful. And so, you know, that's why there's been this kind of stalemate these last several decades where there needs to be action, but the action hasn't worked well, and there's just too much risk to move forward, I would say, until recently.
Okay. So sounds like, all right, so a tremendous amount of latent ROI, just given the progress that has taken place since these mainframes were installed decades ago. You reference, so a bunch of questions. Let's start with verticals. You mentioned banking. Are there any industries in particular, or is this pretty pervasive throughout the economy?
The simple answer is they're everywhere, these systems, right? I think banking is a famous one. Insurance is a famous one. But also government is a famous one, right? But also you can extend this to healthcare, autos. I mean, you know, these systems are generally in the oldest, largest companies in the world. So we're very focused on sort of the Fortune 2000 type company, right? If you're a startup that was founded in 1999 or more recently, you probably haven't got such a system, probably. But if you are a venerable company that's been around for a long time, banks, insurance, government, autos, likely you invested in this technology in the early enterprise computing era, and you probably still have it.
Okay, makes good sense. And so how does Mechanical Orchard think about unlocking value? Is it is your lens cloud, on-prem, or a combination of both?
Yeah. We're mainly offering the chance to these companies, or we're looking to provide a solution that finally offers a chance to retire these old systems and get off them. Now, almost always that means move to a cloud environment. A lot of times it's public, but it can be private, right? Certain of these systems, you can imagine core banking, some banks want to move to a private cloud for good reasons, right? But I'd say more often than not, it's a public cloud target.
Do you find yourself getting in conversation with, say, defense tech, where there are national security reasons why it has to be on-prem? Or do you feel like, as a whole, you know, private cloud security has matured to the point where it's a non-item?
Yeah, no, I mean, when it comes to the US DoD, for example, there are particular needs and particular cloud targets that make sense to stick to. As you probably know, there's a lot of regulation around how you certify software on those clouds and how you become a vendor in those environments. And we're certainly embarking on all of that as a fairly young company. Many of us have experience from the previous company I mentioned of working in that world and having a huge impact in that world, partly because there is such a gap between where that world has been and what is normal nowadays in software development. So there's huge, as you say, huge ROI with these efforts, right? You're going from a very old arcane situation to, we hope to provide, the latest and greatest cloud environment, code base, practices. And the whole idea is to make that a reality, because for most in that old world, that's just a dream, right?
So with that, so the team has a tremendous amount of experience, and you're 2 years in. How have you guys thought about attacking your market? Where traditionally, enterprise level sales, the cycles can be really long.
That's right.
By consequence, lifeblood of any business is cash, but more so for early stage. How have you guys walked the line?
Great, great. So, as you say, enterprise sales are what they are. They take a long time. I would say that this area of focus is only more time, right? Because, of course, these systems are precious crown jewels. There are people who, whose career has been about maintaining these systems, and they know how complicated and fragile they are, right? So you're going to have, let's call it the worst case for an enterprise salesperson to go through this cycle of compliance and security and all the rest of it, right? It's ratchets up all the way, right? The dials are at 11 on all of the difficulties of getting your software in and getting an engagement done. And for a small startup, right, especially early on, that is a difficult task. So number one, it's about understanding the customer, empathy with the customer, being experienced enough to know the lay of the land and to not take lightly the proposal we're putting in front of customers to get off the mainframe at last after all these decades as a small startup, right? So that's number one. If you show up as, oh, this is cool, we're going to do some cool stuff with AI, you're just going to, no one's going to take you seriously, right? So that's number one. I think number two is, you've got to prove you've got something early and often, right? So you can't just sort of build a product and say, this is going to be great. When we're done building it, we're going to sell it and you should come and buy it, right? That's not going to work because the credibility is all that matters in this area, right? It is very difficult to get hold of an old mainframe running production workloads yourself and just play with it, right? So that's a big challenge for us. If you're building many startups, right, you have access to, I don't know, different data sources, APIs out there, and you can play and demo and so on. But for us, where, you can't just find a mainframe lying around that's running production workloads. No one's going to let you play with theirs. So that was a conundrum for us. We were very lucky to get a first customer with a CIO who's known to us, who was so ambitious, right, about moving forward and making progress, that she actually let us, really experiment and try out new techniques. And that gets me to the essence of the company, right? Which is, well, what do we have that can solve this problem that the biggest consultancies haven't really solved perfectly anyway for many decades? And the answer is, it's a different way of thinking about attacking the problem, right? Not to get too technical, but the traditional approach here, if you're a traditional SI faced with a mainframe migration effort, has been to think of the problem as a translation problem, which makes all the sense in the world. You've got this old, like, COBOL code or something like it, and you want to get new code like Java or something to run in the cloud. So, of course, the problem is translation. How do you get from here to here? Maybe it's millions of lines. So let's attack it with lots of people. Let's divide and conquer, right? Let's translate it by looking at documentation, reading code, talking to SMEs at the company. We'll put it all back together, and then somehow we'll make it work, right? With all the integrations and all the data integrations and so on that exist. That's frankly, that's still the basic approach of most in the industry. Now, AI has come along and made this conversation active, I would say. It's kind of woken up again the last, say, 3 years. But we would say that almost all the players in the market are applying AI to that same approach. Right, so they're taking some approach of effectively brute force and applying AI to help the translation. Now, the problem with that is that famously AI is non-deterministic, it hallucinates, et cetera, et cetera. And while that's improving, it's still a problem. So if I take an old code base that's millions of lines that no one really understands, and I just throw AI at it, Gen AI at it, it's going to produce something that might be the same, but might not be the same. And you have to assume it's not. There's a lot of business logic that no one really understands, right? You can imagine the business logic at a bank. It's a huge amount of important business process. And so what happens is with those traditional approaches, there's a use of AI, but it kind of ratchets back from the latest and greatest Gen AI out there, right? You can't really use all that there is in the world of Gen AI. You make it more of a literal translation. So maybe it's faster, but you still kind of have this almost like for like, line by line, so-called transpilation approach. Now I'm exaggerating a bit, but it's not hair on fire Gen AI, let's put it that way. And you still have the problem of putting it all back together and making sure it works. And that's where we think the problem comes, right? Why I say more than half the efforts fail. It's not the translation so much. It's more the putting it all together and does it still work? And how do you cut over from old to new? You end up with a big bang, a huge risk. Fingers are crossed. It's been 3 years and tens of millions. Does it work, right? And because that's so risky for these core systems, it doesn't often follow through. So back to your question, we have a different approach and we tried it out with this customer, let's call it manually, right? Again, not to be too technical, but the approach comes down to rather than thinking of it as a code translation problem first and foremost, rather what we do is we examine the existing system and we look for its dependency graph, right? So what are the different components in code and the different data sources, right? So we have tooling to do that. Suck all that information, that metadata out, give it to a language model, which are really good at understanding graphs and complexity of dependency, right? Then we go to the business team or the users at the company and say, where's your most biggest pain point, right? Like, where do you want to innovate on the code, or where is it very expensive and high compute? And we zoom in on that part of the whole graph of complexity. And then it gets interesting. We actually record the data flows in and out of each of those components. So we don't even look at the code, just record data flows. And we record that day after day after day after day after day, right? So each of those components is doing something to some data. That's what it does, what software does. We record a library of those for weeks and months. And we end up with this recording of what the system does at a low level, which if you can replicate that, right, then you've produced the system again. So we then give an AI agent the task of translating the code. Go ahead and translate now. And by the way, do your worst. Latest and greatest AI, hair on fire, make it human readable, make it beautiful, latest Java code, say. Another agent then says, okay, thanks. I'm going to play those data runs back through your candidate rewrite and see what happens. And if any difference is noticed in the output, they'll have a conversation back and forth and try and solve it, right? So the agents do that. There's also the performance, the speed is being checked as well. So you end up with the AI agentic flow converging on a solution that's really good, clean, human-readable code and is provably equivalent to the old system, right? So that's the different approach.
So let me repeat back what I think I
Yeah,
heard,
yeah.
if I got it right. So instead of looking at the code behind the scenes, you're looking at the output, you're recording the behavior, you're seeking to mimic it, and then you're comparing that to an expected outcome, and then you're leveraging an AI agent to iterate until you get
That's right.
or to validate.
Exactly right. And what that gives is confidence, proof of the equivalent, right?
That's right.
And it off and it lets you use the latest, like I said, hair on fire Gen AI techniques as opposed to retreating from them because you're not sure of the equivalent. So that's a double win. And moreover, it lets you work incrementally. So rather than a big bang, you can move a component one at a time. And so you have a way to not take the system down and de-risk and ratchet forward the progress and give confidence that you're making progress.
I mean, it makes great sense because even if the documentation exists of what the code is intended to do, I mean, oh my God, that would take forever.
Right. And does it do that really? So back to your question, how do we start out? Well, we didn't have this all built in software yet at the beginning of the company, but we did have this concept, this approach. So at our first customer, we went in as a set of developers and we attempted the approach manually. And what happens, right? And we spent 2 years there, right, doing that manually.
Wow.
And we had amazing success, right? So they have now, in the end of that process, they've moved off this mainframe with this core system that literally is from the 60s. There are now people using web browsers and doing normal kind of workflow iteration in software internally, as opposed to green screens where they're banging out, moving things around and inventory management it was. So it worked basically. But along the way, that gave us a lot of credibility because
Sure.
that customer gave us more and more more work to do. They expressed confidence. We learned a lot on a real mainframe. And we began to productize, let's say, or create tooling to automate some of the manual tasks we were doing, right? And late last year, so almost when the company was about 2 years old, we managed to really productize this approach into something that we could use at the next end customers, right? And so now it's a modernization platform for mainframe that we can deploy at the next customers. So that was the cycle, and it was very important to us that we did that hard work with real people digging in and proving it out. And first of all, credibility, but also we learned a ton. If we
Sure.
started the other way around by saying, let's build a product and it'll be great, I don't think we'd anywhere be as far along.
No, I mean, it's textbook. I feel as if today we've put to rest this idea, build it, and people will come. This is, I think, great proof that if you can find a problem, roll your sleeves up, do the hard work. Obviously you don't know the outcome, but in this case, I mean, talk about motivation.
It's also point out that this is a very hard problem. On the face of it, a startup trying to compete with big SIs sounds difficult, and it is, of course, but it's one of the hardest problems in enterprise software, and no one's really cracked it. So in some sense, there's a disruption waiting to happen, and I do think that is true. So there's a huge market out there. There's an estimate from Gartner that there are between 250 and 750 billion lines of COBOL in the world running in production, right? If you can imagine like some dollar per line of code fee on average, right? That's a big TAM, and that gets me to the next point about how we grew, which was to choose the early investors carefully. Right. And explain to them how this could be disruptive and so on, which we can talk about if that's useful.
Yes, some more questions, but let's go there. So, obviously a big decision of whether or not to bring investors on a cap table. Can you please shed a light on what that discussion looked like internally, and then how did you guys go about evaluating your investors before accepting their checks?
Absolutely, I would call the overall cycle, we're now post Series B by close to a year, as pretty standard, although accelerated. So first, angel investors, right? So these were personal friends from the industry for many decades, right? So people we trusted, knew, worked with or for us in the past, or we worked for them in the past. These were people with deep pockets who, believed in the founders, right? And probably saw the TAM out there for this opportunity, but there was nothing to prove it yet. But they
Sure.
believed in us, right? So we very carefully picked the friends of ours, to get us some seed capital. It was the Series A that was really the big first decision, which is was led by Emergence Capital,
Okay.
which was a firm. I don't know if your listeners are familiar with it, but a very successful firm in San Francisco, with some really amazing founders and partners, which we grew to know. There was a rush to invest, but we felt like they were the ideal first partner, given their portfolio, their focus. They make very few investments, they make very careful bets, and they look for big disruptive companies. So we were kind of right in their wheelhouse.
Perfect.
That was a relationship that developed for quite a while, and they led the Series A. Now that was in late 23, so about a year into the company, then soon after that, we were approached by just a long line of corporate VCs, right, as well as traditional venture capitalists. These were corporate VCs from banks, insurance companies, et cetera, the target market, who I think were very excited about the prospect of investing because they know their own company needs something like
Sure.
this, right? It was a full-time job for several of us to just to understand what was happening, like which investors are coming to us with what reason. I mean, it was, I don't want to boast, but it was, I've never seen the level of interest from the sort of Series B crowd who just saw the opportunity. I think definitely AI and the hype around it was part of that, right? Because a year ago, that was all everyone was talking about, and maybe still is. But I think our story about a serious enterprise problem with a large addressable market, and a use of AI that you could explain, like I just did, and is a real thing as opposed to some hype.
Sure.
Tight. We ended up being very specific, given that there was a queue, right? Which was, we need customers. We need to get going with some early, really good relationships, design partner customers. So frankly, if you want to invest in us, we need to see what you can bring us, right? So we were very open about that, which I know many are, but I've never been quite so direct as, with very well-known names as to say, okay, well, show me what you can do, right? So
Sure.
that was humbling slash amazing to go through. Several of us have raised money in the past, and I think for us it was kind of, so this is what real interest looks like, I guess, right? Because before it wasn't that interesting in other fundraising. Now, during that time, we were approached by, as I said, many different corporate VCs. But in the end, Google Ventures was the
Okay.
one that stood out to us, GV, primarily because we felt that their vision, technology-wise, for what could happen here, the tipping point the industry's at, matched ours, and they were very aggressive, like we are, in terms of what let's go and do this. Now's the time, right? And they have deep pockets, of course, and they're related to GCP, of course, Google Cloud, of course. But it was really more the vision they had for what could be done in the industry that led us to effectively choose them. We're always quick to say that we're not locked into Google Cloud; we're agnostic to cloud. I think GV's investments are actually. Less than half are actually use Google Cloud, so it's not like they lock us into Google. But obviously, that relationship has been helped, the Google Cloud relationship, by this investment, which helped
Sure.
get going. And it happened to be Google Cloud that our first customer used, et cetera. So, but it was really more the vision and the people at Google that many of us have known for a long time. Again, relationships for decades. We did some consulting at Google. In 2003, I was an engineer at the time, and I actually have contractor badge number one, so it goes way back to 2004. So that relationship was there, and the trust was there as well. So both those Series A and Series B leads, came out of a lot of trust and history. Along the way, there were some other really important investors that we chose or helped to select based on our go-to-market. So we have Finn Capital as an investor, mainly because of the financial focus of the go-to-market. We have Munich Re, which is a reinsurer for many of the big insurance companies, again because of the insurance market. And we have MongoDB actually as well, which is an investor that came out of the need for figuring out the data migration story from these old data stores to something modern. And we think that the
Sure.
document database is an interesting target for many workloads.
I think it's makes a lot of sense that not only do you accept capital from people that trust, but also where there's alignment and
Yes, yes.
everyone's rowing in the same direction.
That's right.
It's
This
across the board.
problem space is very much which side of history are you going to be on here, right? There's a huge industry of maintaining mainframes, of servicing mainframes, and frankly, many who approached us are in that world, right? And then there's a other side of history where the cloud providers sit, the modern data store people sit, we sit, and very few services companies sit, which is why we announced a very important partnership with ThoughtWorks. Last week at Google Next. So they are now our services partner, which gives us a lot of scale, as you can imagine, and relationships and acceleration in our go-to-market. That relationship also goes back about 25, 30 years. The culture that
Fantastic.
they have is very similar. The mentality, Rob, the CEO here, is good friends with the chief scientist, Martin Fowler, at ThoughtWorks. So we it's kind of a two peas in a pod relationship, and they are certainly on this side of history as well, having had no real foot in the mainframe maintenance market. So yes, I completely agree. As a startup, the best thing you can do, and I was told this by Paul Moritz. I don't know if you know Paul Moritz's name, but he was I think number three at Microsoft in the 90s, famously was the guy behind Windows NT, CEO of VMware, CEO of Pivotal, very experienced leader. And he always said, get on the right side of history, right? Because things will fall your way over time, right?
Sure.
I think, I mean, it's an opinion, but I think there is a tipping point that people are reaching with their patience on this mainframe stuff. And so I think that's been to fall into place for us. And these partners that have shown up, which I think will be another interesting point here, how to think about partners, right, have been key for us. I mean, as a small software company, we're about 110 people today, although we're probably growing our R&D team soon. As a relatively small company, we're not going to go and win these big enterprise deals solo. We'll win some, but we're not going
Sure.
to scale that way. And so having, in the case of a small product company, having an important services partner that understands the vision, that really wants to make the product successful, that is culturally similar to you, I think that's probably the main thing I looked for when choosing a services partner, as opposed to just, whichever large services company comes knocking, which is very tempting, right? Because you've got global companies with tens of thousands of employees who can tell you the stories they can tell you, but do they really understand and they're going to be with you on this disruptive journey? That's the question.
100%. I sometimes, so my sense is, we I don't know that it's necessarily underestimate culture. Maybe it's because we're not necessarily in a position yet where we can take advantage of it is a good way to characterize it. But just what sounds like you guys are having phenomenal success, that yes, I mean, if you can find a partner who thinks about business execution vision the same way you do, I mean, makes all the sense in the world. Little bit in the weeds. It's a topic that's come up a handful of times, and that's patents on technology. Obviously, it sounds like you have some pretty impressive IP. Would love to know how the company thinks about protecting that with patents.
Absolutely, yeah. So we had our launch of our product, which is called Imogen, Imogen, this old English name that came out of a geeky joke about the command line of our interfaces. MO, Mechanical Orchard, space, gen for generate, MO gen, which sounds a bit like Imogen. We launched that at Google Next last week, less than a week ago. It was very important to us to file a patent before that public launch, right? And so, yes, we've filed a specific patent, which, this is not my area of expertise, but what the company ended up doing was really focusing on the essence of what was different, right? It's very tempting to try and say, this whole thing we do, that's the patent, right? But we have a very broad offering, right? We're going from take your mainframe where it is, all the way over to modern code running on cloud that's readable and changeable, and the cost of change is de minimis. That's a very broad thing to be done, and it's tempting to kind of make your patent as, but there's something in the middle of that that's the essence, that's different, that's special, that in the end is the make or break for our company. We made ourselves focus way down on that, right? Which is, it can be a little bit disconcerting because what about the other stuff we do? It's really important too. Yeah, but is it really differentiating? Is it really special? Is it really defensible, et cetera? So that's how we approached it, and we have filed such a patent.
Fantastic. Yeah, no, I mean, the topic comes up. I've heard debates on either side, but I think especially when you have something really unique on your hands, it makes good sense because it satisfies C-suite, the board, current potential investors.
I've also had it's useful to have such a mentality of what's really patentable. I've actually been asked by partners and customers, like, what is it that you've patented, right? And they're looking not to, I don't know, take over your idea, but rather like, what's really special about you? They really want to, and the patent can be a good way to answer that question, right?
That's right. Earlier you mentioned as part of the solution are leveraging AI agents. big topic for 2025 as they start to come into the fore. I'd love to get your perspective on the outlook of AI agents. Do you think it's really use case by use case, or do you think we're at the tip of the iceberg for purposes of automation?
Wow, big question. Let me start with for us what we think in terms of our domain, and I can offer an opinion of the bigger picture. The use of an AI agent or the agentic workflow that you hear about every day these days is a very powerful, emotionally compelling idea, right? It's like you have these bots basically working together to do something difficult. Amazing, right? Let's use that. The reason we, I think, impressed the early investors is that we had a very specific need that happens to match that really well, right? We weren't out to find a way to use agents. We were out to apply that approach that I mentioned. And we realized along the way that to solve for that code being equivalent and optimized, it turns out that a back and forth conversation of equivalence and great code was actually a good use case, right? So I can authentically say we came to it that way versus we tried to find a way to use hype, right? And so that might sound a little bit self-serving, but that is what happened. And I think our investors didn't invest in us because we're an AI hype cycle company, but rather we have this addressable market and this approach. And then
Sure.
the AI part of it was like, well, that's extra cool, but who knows if that's going to be hype in 3 years, right? So I think at this company, the leadership down, we're quite sober. We're quite long-term thinkers. We've been around a while. We've seen fads come and go a million times. And so we're skeptical, you might say, about the use of technology for technology's sake, right? It's got to be a business reason. And if it turns out that the hype right now helps it, true, then great. I would hasten to add, of course, that without Gen AI, we probably couldn't do what we're doing, right? It would be too slow and manual. So I don't want to say it's, whatever with AI. It's very important to us. But it was more it was a means to an end rather than let's try and find a way to use AI to solve a problem, right?
Understood.
Now, to broaden the conversation, I think you can probably tell I'm a little cynical about some of these trends, but having said that, I think there's something different about the notion of an agentic generative AI workload, and we all feel it. We all see it out there in the media, in our daily lives. I mean, I tend to go to ChatGPT more than I go to google.com now, which is amazing. That's a 25-year habit that I have to sort of break. And so I think that there is a hype that happened here, and it's in the enterprise world, especially going through the usual kind of trough before it goes up again, meaning, what about security of data? I don't understand how this really works. I don't trust that you're not using my data for bad things. We've got to solve that in a better way than the industry has right now when it comes to enterprise data, personal information, banking, et cetera, being prime candidates. So there's that out there, but the people are working on that and it's getting better, right? You can do more stuff, in quotes, locally than before. I think there are some very canonical use cases that make absolute sense to use agentic workflows for. The classic one being the outsourcing of your trouble ticket, consumer interface, right? You've seen Google launch entire products around automating your ticket center, right? And there are others. But I think we're at a place where people are asking, what really is the use case again? Like, what do you want to really use this for? And can you show me it's secure? Now, to answer your question directly, I think there are many use cases, especially in large enterprise, and they're more than just the usual chat agent and search the intranet ones. But I think they're emerging, and time will tell which ones really hit. So I think there's a big thing happening here. I really do. I think the agentic notion is a huge move forward, as big or bigger than, say, cloud. But I think the use cases are yet to really emerge, except for the obvious ones, and they will, just based on, trial and error and the proof of time.
I mean, it makes great sense. I think especially if you start to see early success, it's encouraging.
The enterprise buyer is a cynical person for good reason, right? They want to show me what it is. And if you haven't really got something that really helps them, they're not going to buy, right? It's as simple as that.
Edward, it's been a great podcast. One of the questions I enjoy wrapping up with is if you had an opportunity to have a conversation with your younger self, what would you share?
Well, I grew up in the UK at a time when coding and tech was not on the horizon for a career. But somehow I was very much drawn to engineering, coding as a young person. I'm talking about, 9, 10, 11, 12. Would read all the magazines. No one I knew coded or cared about it, and it was a passionate thing. I mean, I didn't ever think of it as a career because no one around me ever thought of that. In fact, at college, I was advised, "Hey, if you want to be a software person, that's cool, but there's no money there. It's like being an artist or a musician or something. I mean, sure, fine, but you should really go to the city and be a financial guy with your math degree, right?"
It's funny.
And so it was very tempting, of course, to follow the herd to the city in London and do a great career, which I respect and so on, in banking or whatever. But I could tell that wasn't my path. And I really moved to San Francisco, to Silicon Valley. Yes, I knew there was jobs out there in the late 90s, but I had no sense that it was a great career. The starting salaries weren't, higher than bankers, et cetera, et cetera. So I think the kind of simple, trite, flowery answer to your question is truly listen to your inner voice about what really you enjoy, right? Because my goodness, life is hard if you don't. And if you're really going to go for your career, choose the thing that you love, right? And of course, I got lucky, software ate the world, et cetera. But I believe that. I tell my kids the same. I think it's just very important for your success, let alone mental health, to follow what you love. And I think most people kind of know deep down if they love something or not.
Yeah, I 100% agree. I mean, passion helps mitigate the wrong stress. There's still stress, but
yes.
Arguably the right one.
Yes.
Edward, it's been a great podcast. If any of our listeners would like to get a hold of you, how can they find you?
Yeah, so mechanicalorchard.com with a hyphen in between. My name's Edward. I am on LinkedIn and Twitter and the rest of it, or sorry, X. Happy to talk to anyone interested.
Fantastic. Again, Edward Hyatt, Chief Customer Officer and board member at Mechanical Orchard. Edward, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast.
Thank you.
Again, I'm your host, Christian Marquez, founder, CEO of FinStrat Management. Thank you for joining us. Take care. Christian Marquez here. Thank you so much for listening to the Innovators and Investors podcast. If you're a successful founder or an investor, would like to be on the podcast, please visit podcast.finstratmgmt.com. If you know someone that would be a great guest, please tag them on social media to let them know about the show and include the hashtag Innovators and Investors. I'd love to see your posts and suggestions. We're regularly putting out new episodes and content. To make sure you catch each new episode, please subscribe to the Innovators and Investors podcast. And your thumbs up, ratings, and reviews go a long way to help promote the show, and it means a lot to me and my team. Would you like to know more? Go to our website, finstratmgmt.com, or follow us on LinkedIn or on X. Our handle is at finstratmgmt. This is Christian Marquez. Thank you for listening. Until next time.